From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar, and this week we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org. Eric, welcome back. Hope you've had
Don, always a pleasure.
Hope you had a fun week.
Maybe a little bit.
A lot going on.
My God, it really is. I mean, I had all these things I wanted to talk about this week, and everything's getting preempted by multiple huge stories.
Yeah, I mean, we've had earth-shattering stuff like Brexit and the fallout from that, and now we have a terrorist, actually a pair of terrorist attacks in Bangladesh, the killing of a cleric in the morning, and then the taking of a restaurant inside the diplomatic district, one of the most fortified places in the country, and both of those, part of a string, has been over the past few months a series of attacks where ISIS has been claimed to have taken, where ISIS claimed to have taken responsibility.
Well, interestingly, Don, I have seen a couple of those instances that ISIS hasn't even done that, but the media seems to be ascribing responsibility right to them. So, I mean, I don't know whether what to take out of that, whether that means that ISIS is just not taking responsibility for everything that they've done, or whether that's the media using each and every terrorist incident as yet another means of sort of propping up a military industrial complex kind of narrative. I mean, I think that's an open question.
You know, if you take a look at a map of where Bangladesh is and where Iraq and Syria and the Islamic State pseudo-caliphate are, it's and taking the position of self-interest of ISIS, if it's really as described, this group that is an independent actor that is seeking its own goal of establishing a caliphate between Iraq and Syria, it doesn't make much sense for them to be conducting terrorist activity against Bangladesh. And also, it seems difficult to project power across India to that spot inside the most fortified area, for what purpose?
Well, yeah, and again, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this really kind of falls under this larger umbrella category of Islamic State activities outside of Islamic State territory by far. I mean, and this isn't the first example we have of this. I have written about it. A number of other people have written about it. The penetration of Islamic State forces into Afghanistan, you know, a place that really is geographically very isolated from the so-called caliphate. It is a very different kind of country and a very different scenario, obviously, with a U.S. military occupation still ongoing there, with all of the different factions fighting there, including the Taliban, including the various Al-Qaeda allied forces and all the other grouplets that are fighting in Afghanistan. And yet ISIS has injected itself there, or at least that's what we're told. And so, looking at it in that way, similarly, we now see in Bangladesh, apparently, a presence of the Islamic State, one that is significant enough to be carrying out a major terrorist action. Look, this is not simply, you know, setting a bomb somewhere. This is not a suicide bombing. I mean, this is a full-blown, you know, hostage situation, hostage-taking scenario, which obviously requires a lot more planning, particularly since it's, a short walk away from some of the major international institutions in the capital there in Dhaka, including the U.S. I think it's the U.S. Embassy or the U.S. Consulate there, including a number of other key diplomatic facilities. So obviously this required a level of sophistication that certainly raises some questions, probably raises more questions than it answers.
You know, there's always the question of who benefits. And Bangladesh shares with some of the other places where ISIS has been active I'd say, independence from the United States and its foreign policy. The U.S. has been seeking to establish a naval base there for many years now. It is a choke point entering the South China Sea from the west, and Bangladesh has been refusing. I'm wondering if you think there might be some connection between that fact and the fact that they become targets of ISIS, quote-unquote.
Well, again, I mean, we have to be cautious about either accepting the narrative of the corporate media, which is that everything that happens in the world that's bad is ISIS, and it's always convenient for the U.S. policy establishment. On the other hand, we have to also be cautious about unfounded sort of speculation yeah. about what may or may not have happened and who may or may not be behind it. But to your point, and I think that this is really what we're focused on in this program, is the larger political and geopolitical and strategic implications of these kinds of things. Obviously, we could do an entire hour right now on the implications of the terrorist bombing in the airport in Istanbul, and that has clear and unmistakable geopolitical and strategic implications vis-a-vis Syria and Russia and all of the issues surrounding that region, particularly right now. Similarly, in Bangladesh, there's no way to ignore how fortuitous something like this would be for the United States, which is desperate to provide some kind of a political cover, a justification for increased military penetration of the subcontinent. Ultimately, that's what this is about. I think, what was it, maybe 2 or 3 months ago now, Don, when we were talking at length on this program about, you know, my series, BRICS Under Attack, and in particular, India, and how the United States was trying to make sure that its tentacles were deeply entrenched in India using military cooperation agreements. And those agreements are now pretty much finalized, as far as I know. And I will admit, I haven't checked in the last couple of weeks. I don't know whether the final ink is on the paper, so to speak, but pretty much we can say India is now a direct military ally of the United States. We now see joint military exercises being carried out, particularly in some of these key waterways. And so looking at that from that sort of strategic perspective, then it certainly does raise the question, just how lucky is the United States now that ISIS is attacking Bangladesh, giving potentially the sort of the much needed push, if you will, for Bangladesh to accept U.S. military so-called cooperation, or maybe a better way of saying that would be domination, and using Bangladesh as a means of effecting this larger military what do we call it, chessboard scenario against China. Ultimately, I think that that's what this is about. Quite frankly, pretty much everything going on in Asia right now is related to China in one way or another. And when the U.S. is involved, it's certainly directed at China. And as you alluded to, this is a critical piece of real estate here. You're talking about entrance to the South China Sea from the west, specifically the transit into the Straits of Malacca, right? Once you get into that critical choke point there off of Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, in that region there, I mean, so much of global shipping, and in particular, China's shipping, commercial shipping, goes through the Straits of Malacca. It's one of the critical reasons why China has been so adamant about its maritime rights, about the South China Sea and the so-called freedom of navigation issue. All of these things are directly connected to Chinese access to larger markets outside of Southeast Asia, allowing Chinese commercial shipping unfettered access to places like Africa, for example. So when you see something like this and you see the U.S. maneuvering its military forces into that region, you can rest assured it really is all about China. And this is true on a number of issues. And I think that this is true of what's happening in Bangladesh and U.S. military basing rights in that country for sure.
You know, there was an article back in March at Reuters' website talking about the first overseas naval base for China, which was in Djibouti. which is at the far end of this. It speculates that, and it has some American officials speculating that what China is seeking to do is lay out a string of pearls from China to Djibouti, and that this might be one of them, one place where they'd be looking to base naval forces.
No, there's no doubt. Look, the string of pearls strategy goes back a number of years. I think it was, I want to say 2005, and I can't remember the admiral's name now, or he might not have even been an admiral, I'm not sure. But anyway, the guy at the U.S. Army War College who wrote the famous paper all about the string of pearls, China's string of pearls strategy, I think it was called, or something like that, right? And this is like official U.S. military doctrine, right? This is U.S. military analysis of what China was doing, and basically just to draw the picture a little bit for listeners who might not be familiar with the term string of pearls is basically the concept that China was creating this sort of unbroken string of bases stretching from the Chinese mainland all the way across the Indian Ocean to Africa in order to be able to fortify and control what are called SLOCs. That's the sea lines of communication, right? That is basically what I was alluding to. Their freedom of navigation, access to these commercial shipping lanes. And so the idea was that Chinese military power projection was basically intended to more or less protect Chinese commercial shipping interests. And this, taken to its sort of logical development, basically means that China targets these key countries all along the route from the South China Sea to the Red Sea, you know, through the Bab al-Mandeb Strait to the Red Sea in Africa, that China is engaged in developing this sort of quasi-military, quasi-commercial architecture all through that region. And so this notion of breaking the string of pearls, of breaking China's sort of unbroken string of these facilities, that is part of the U.S. sort of military doctrine, which goes hand in hand with the geopolitical and strategic angle to all of this. And I think that that is something that really needs to be looked at very carefully. And there's a number of reasons why we need to pay attention to this. I think it was it 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago or whenever that was, we were talking about the Iranian port at Chabahar,
right,
and the Pakistani port at Gwadar. Okay, this is an example of exactly this same issue. China in Gwadar in Pakistan attempting to control a major deep water port that gives them commercial access via land to the Indian Ocean, overland through China into Pakistan and directly to the Indian Ocean. Why do they need that? Why is that so critical for China? It allows them to bypass the Straits of Malacca, to bypass those commercial shipping lanes, the maritime access, and allows them to diversify their supply chain of imports and exports. Okay, so that is part of how China is reading the sort of the political map, as it were, of the region. And I think that what we see with Bangladesh is another example of that. What we see in Myanmar is another example of that. The Chinese twin pipelines going through Myanmar into southwestern China, into the Yunnan province, a very important economic development project that they're involved in. So I think that you're right to point to Bangladesh as perhaps yet another flashpoint of, I guess, what we might call the 21st century great game, right? The great game between the U.S. and China for access, influence, and control throughout Southeast Asia and South Asia.
And you can see the intensity of the conflict and the broad nature of it in all of the many contradictions. For example, bringing both Pakistan and India into the SCO, certainly a project that China would like to see really Yep. develop well. And, you know, you mentioned Myanmar and, you know, we're talking about Bangladesh. Djibouti is at the far end, the prize, and Africa ultimately. The U.S. is pushing on multiple fronts, and this is happening at a time that there are some temporary victories, like in Brazil, for example, and Argentina. I mean, I don't think they're sustainable, but without military dictatorships being imposed, but
which are possible,
which is possible, and may well come to fruition. But you know, there's a push back and forth, but the overall trend has been the rise of China and multilateralism, and loss of ground by the United States and the EU, which itself is going through an existential crisis, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think that the U.S. sort of counter maneuvers are significant, but they're also specific by region. You know, for instance, the way that the U.S. is attempting to reassert its influence and control in Latin America is distinctly different from what the U.S. can actually achieve in places like Southeast Asia. And I know we sort of said we weren't going to get into it too deeply, but I do just want to point out very quickly. The establishment of Fulbright University in Vietnam is a very important node of U.S. soft power, in my view. Yeah. This is the first private Western-style university to be established in Vietnam. And what do you think it's there for? It is to train the next generation of political elites and economic elites in Vietnam to have a U.S.-centric, pro-Western worldview with specifically an antipathy towards China.
Right.
This is one of the ways that the U.S. is using soft power to achieve in Southeast Asia what they're achieving in Latin America using counter-revolutionary far-right-wing proxies inside of those countries. So while the tactics are somewhat different depending on the region, they are, I think, in my view, part of a cohesive whole, and that is a strategy by the U.S. to counter the rise of China and also the rise of Russia in certain other areas, in particular, Ukraine, Eastern Europe, and also Central Asia. So this is really, I think, to put it in Brzezinskian terms, this is the grand chessboard that we're now looking at. And I think that we do, as you were sort of suggesting at the beginning of our conversation, I think we do need to place these acts of terrorism, be they in Turkey or in Bangladesh, into this category. Now, this is not to say that we're 100%, certain that this is, conspiracy theory and that, that ISIS is 100% controlled by the U.S.
I wouldn't even assert that there was a self-awareness of the whole picture on their part. But it happens within this context, however,
yes,
and those are the effects it has on the big game, the great game.
That's exactly my point. You said it better than I could. Exactly. That we don't necessarily care the extent to which it's active or it's unconscious or passive. Ultimately, that is the end product of all of this. We already know that the U.S. was not concerned about the rise of ISIS in 2012. That Defense Intelligence Agency memo, thank God Judicial Watch did the important FOIA work to get that document out publicly. We know that the U.S. knew all about the rise of ISIS in 2012 and looked the other way because they thought it would be a convenient tool that they could use to effect regime change in Syria. So then my question then would be, as a sort of a follow-up to that, if we know that to be true, which we do, then why would it be a stretch to assume that the U.S. would attempt to harness the capability and the barbarism and brutality of the Islamic State for its own purposes elsewhere? If they're willing to do it in Syria, why wouldn't they be willing to do it in Afghanistan? Why wouldn't they be willing to do it in Bangladesh? Of course they would. And in fact, this goes back to the same point we were just making, namely that these countries like Bangladesh and Afghanistan, which seem seemingly are off the radar for a lot of people, are in many ways the front lines of these growing conflicts between the U.S. and China. Take Afghanistan, for example. In Afghanistan, you have a situation where the U.S. has been militarily occupying that country for 15 years, okay? Ultimately, there will come a day when that occupation, that direct military occupation, is going to end. It has to. It has to, okay? Now, there are forces in the region who are preparing themselves for that day, who are preparing to move in and become major players in Afghanistan. And the two biggest ones are China and India. Okay, so you can already see in just in the context of Afghanistan how the United States wants to maneuver itself. It wants to be able to drive a wedge between China and India in Afghanistan. In particular, it's the investments around iron ore, but it's also, you know, certain other strategic minerals, and also, of course, it's about the New Silk Road, One Belt, One Road strategy, Afghanistan as a critical transit point, potentially also for pipelines. You know, so there's a lot of these issues that swirl around Afghanistan, and I think that that is something that needs to be watched and it needs to be understood. And to bring it back to Bangladesh, though, in many ways, Bangladesh is in a pretty similar situation. Remember, Bangladesh is really critical for a lot of the big retailers in the United States and in the West. A lot of those products, especially in the textile industry, come out of Bangladesh. There's billions upon billions of dollars of capital invested in that supply chain, much of which comes out of Bangladesh. So there's an economic incentive here, and then the strategic geopolitical incentive, of course, as well. It gives the pretext for U.S. naval access to Bangladesh itself, but especially the Bay of Bengal, the Indian Ocean, and the region leading towards the Straits of Malacca.
I'm wondering, when you discuss Afghanistan in the context that you just did, where it looks like a minor great game is shaping up between India and China in Afghanistan. Is it going to stay in turmoil, you know, perpetually? Is that the game that people are playing, that if I can't have it, we're going to deny it to the other party? And is that going to be the fate of all these places at these hot, you know, at these key junctures?
Well, I wouldn't want to say it's necessarily a one-size-fits-all strategy, but to your point, I think that our recent history, and when I say our, I mean the U.S. military industrial complex, U.S. intelligence, it's not really our. I don't consider that.
Yeah, right.
I don't consider us a part of that.
They consider us theirs, actually.
Right, but
yeah.
Right. But when you consider the history of U.S. military and U.S. intelligence recently, let's say the last 10 years or so, there is this question that I've argued a number of times, that is the perpetual fallback option if they can't affect exactly the kind of changes they want with puppet governments and regime changes and proxies and all of the rest of that, then is the secondary option just chaos, to maintain and to spread chaos as much as possible as essentially a means of depriving their rivals of access? I mean, look, some people buy that, some people don't. I know that, like, Pepe Escobar has written a book, I think, right? He calls it Empire of Chaos. So there is an entire school of thought that says that chaos is inevitably a fallback option. I tend to agree with that. I think that the U.S. sort of always does that when it can't get exactly what it wants. I think a perfect example of that, and we'll maybe touch on it a little bit later, is Libya. I think Libya provides an excellent example of how the U.S. is perfectly comfortable destroying a country and letting it fall into chaos if that perpetuates and leads towards the larger strategic objectives that the U.S. has. And similarly, in Afghanistan, look, there's a couple of developments that I think are particularly worrying for Washington. And I think number one on that list, and this goes back now a couple of years, and allegedly, it's still happening now, direct contact and direct negotiations between the Taliban and the political forces in Afghanistan, which is only able to happen. It's only made possible because of China having direct access to the Taliban, not Taliban representatives in the United Arab Emirates, you know, in Dubai or wherever they are, you know, for international consumption purposes, but the real on the ground Taliban elements. The Chinese are engaging in dialogue with these people. Now, what does that mean? That means that China sees a long-term strategy in Afghanistan wherein it becomes the dominant political player. It becomes the dominant economic force. So a lot of those concessions for iron ore and other minerals and a lot of that stuff, that will now be up in the air as China becomes a major player there. And India, for its part, has long-term visions for Afghanistan as well. And Afghanistan is the source of the minerals that India wants to bring into its own country. And how will it do that? What is the number one means by which that's going to happen? Chabahar. Chabahar port in Iran on the coast there is funded and backed by India for a lot of reasons, but the main reason being access to exports coming out of Afghanistan. So you see definitely this sort of great game scenario playing out there. And similarly, I think Bangladesh is fitting into this as well, albeit for slightly different reasons.
I think let's go back to, you mentioned Libya. Let's visit that a little deeper for a minute, because when I was there in 2009, you could see construction going up all over Tripoli, both by Chinese construction companies and South Korean construction companies. Now, China has been, tempting South Korea affirmatively and aggressively in terms of economic issues, trade agreements and such, and does a great deal of business with South Korea. And as you see that kind of competition for the affections of these different players play out, look at Gaddafi's role in Africa. The great game is taking place in Africa for sure between China and the U.S. and EU. And, Gaddafi struck a very independent course, had a bunch of money, said he'd bankroll the United States of Africa, and was well into the process of doing that when they took him out. And I'm envisioning a Gaddafi-advised African Union with money in the bank and their own military forces, where you have Chinese and South Korean companies working together and making a lot of money for everyone, including Africans, as a model to be denied. And they took out Libya and turned it into chaos, and suddenly that's not possible.
That's right. And not only that, you're 100% right. And even taking it further, not only did they destroy Libya and send it into chaos, they exported the chaos out of Libya across North Africa and into West Africa. Right. Look, the bottom line is, and we need to be real about this, people need to understand the implications of what happened in Libya, why you and I and just a tiny fraction of the anti-war movement, which itself is pretty moribund, why we were so vehemently opposed to what was being done to Libya. It was for all of the reasons you were mentioning: independent development, leadership, integration in Africa, a brighter future for Africa, and all of that. But it was also because we knew, going back to 2011, that what was going to come out of that was going to be chaos and destabilization for all of Africa. And let's be perfectly frank about it. There would be no Boko Haram if there had been no war in Libya. There would be no internecine conflict in Nigeria being stoked by these vicious murderers whose weapons came directly out of Libya. Okay, those weapons that flowed west, that went into the Sahel, those are now in the hands of the so-called AQIM, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. They're in the hands of Boko Haram. Those weapons that went south into Chad and then west into Niger, those are in the hands of Boko Haram. The sort of the scramble for oil resources around Lake Chad, where Nigeria and Cameroon and Niger and Chad are all competing competing for oil, none of that would be happening. If Gaddafi was in power, if Libya was still the leading light of African development, none of that would be going on. We see a number of these kind of and by the way, let's not forget the overthrow and subsequent civil war and subsequent destabilization in Mali. That also wouldn't have happened had the war in Libya not taken place. So the implications of that then brings us back to what we were just talking about, this notion of chaos and controlled chaos and managed chaos. I think that we see a very clear indication in Africa of how the U.S. has done that. And if you want a parallel, if you want a sort of something to compare that against, look at the managed chaos that has been wrought on Congo, right? For more than for 20 years now, we're in 2016, since 1996, you have more than 6 million Congolese dead because of a conflict that the U.S. has not only stoked and fomented, but has deliberately sabotaged attempts to resolve, right? Using its tin pot dictator friend in Rwanda, Paul Kagame, using the guns that they run out of Uganda and with Museveni, although Museveni is now wavering and might not be such a U.S. ally as he once was. So you see in the Great Lakes region an example of what chaos and managed chaos can do. It's not that the United States wants to directly control Congo. It's that they want to be able to mediate any attempts to create a peaceful situation, to manage the chaos to its own beneficial outcomes. That's what you see in North and West Africa as well. And Libya was in many ways the jumping off point for that. And look at the situation inside of Libya right now. You have a country that really doesn't exist as a real country anymore. It's broken down into a number of conflicting and warring factions, including a Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda affiliated group in Tripoli, the so-called Libya Dawn, and the various brigades that are around them, including now an internationally recognized government housed in Tobruk, which is more or less the legitimate government of Libya now, that is actually trying to reassert some level of order to that country, but they're being blocked by all of these different factions. And inside the country, you have the Islamic State, and coordinating all of this, at least according to a number of reports, coordinating it are people like Abdel Hakim Belhaj, who was the so-called hero backed by the United States, who really kind of led the push of the Al-Qaeda terrorists to overthrow Gaddafi. Make no mistake, these were Al-Qaeda terrorists, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, the various martyrs brigades, and all of the rest of them that were involved in that were directly backed by the U.S. So again, we see how the U.S. harnesses terrorism as a weapon to effect a political outcome. So when we say that ISIS is conveniently doing the bidding of the U.S. in Bangladesh or in Afghanistan, it's not just out of our rear ends that we're pulling this idea. It comes from a clear and unmistakable historical legacy and narrative of the U.S. doing precisely that.
And yet, you have the SCO meeting, the business conference that was in St. Petersburg before that. You have the Eurasian Organization meeting also, and very, very important material outcomes from most of those in terms of trade agreements, in terms of statements of geostrategic interests, coincidental, and basically an expression of geopolitical solidarity between Russia and China. All these things happening. And also in Brazil, by the way, a finding by, I think, the Supreme Court that the basis of the charge against Rousseff is not finding against that on a fact finding, that she didn't do what they claim she did without even passing on the legality of it. So who knows, Rousseff may end up next month being president again. All kinds of pushback at various levels from top to bottom.
And interesting how that's happening on the eve of the Olympics. Because I mean, this is a really important moment for Brazil. The Olympics are probably, I don't know. I mean, probably one of the most important revenue generating mechanisms for any country. I mean, the Olympics generates huge money and a global spotlight on a country. And so the fact that there is this real political turmoil, I think, it's at the very least, it's interesting and significant, and then sort of these ongoing push and pull between some of the civil servants. You know, I mean, we hear about police who are not getting paid by the government. Now, what's going to happen? Are they going to try to blame that on Rousseff and the Workers' Party?
And then inside the Olympics, themselves, there's this all this pushing back and forth, doping allegations, and keep Russia out, and is it going to happen or not? And the same thing that they played with Sochi. With the toilets don't work and everything. It's like this massive PR campaign to discredit it as well. After the Zika thing failed because they forgot to check the calendar, figured out Summer Olympics were actually taking place in the winter in Rio, so the mosquito threat was at least abated a little.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wrote a piece on the Russia doping issue and whatever. And I mean, look, I can't say yes or no whether they were or weren't doping. I mean, I would assume, and I don't know, but I would assume that they have some kind of evidence, including historically, you know, issues in the Russian program, issues in programs in other countries. But that's precisely the point. It's not Russia alone that has this doping issue, including we've had examples of that in the U.S. and in Canada as well. So the fact of the matter is that it's obviously been politicized, and it's been politicized right. In a way that is, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, pretty transparent what it's about, you know. And again, we should remember that it is the U.S. that has deeply politicized just about every Olympics. I mean, who could forget Putin sitting next to George Bush in Beijing in 2008? The word that Mikhail Saakashvili and the Georgian forces are bombing Russians in South Ossetia, you know, that was literally on the day of the opening ceremonies in Beijing, similarly in Sochi as well. But you know, so anyway, not focusing too much on the Olympics issue. I just want to highlight the fact.
Before you do, I want to put it within Brazilian context, because essentially the Olympics is a huge star for Brazil, for the Brazilian government, and Rousseff is the one that brought it there, and she and Lula, I'm sure, helped. And then she's pushed out, and you have all this attack on it in a public relations way in the West. And you have a government with the president has 0% support now, I think that was the last poll, is going to be the face of it. And he might be wearing the problems, or he might be able to, get a nice public face out of it. But still, it's Rousseff's baby. So they have a real PR problem over this.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that... Yes, I agree. And I wonder, you know, are they going to try to pin whatever problems do emerge out of the Olympics? Are they going to try to pin that on Rousseff, say poor planning and corruption and all of the rest of that?
Sure.
I mean, there's no doubt that's what they're going to try to do. Whether that will stick or not, I doubt it. I think that it's interesting because even the corporate media really had a hard time swallowing the coup against Rousseff. I mean, gosh, I saw... really deeply reactionary publications coming out with stuff that I agreed with on the issue, including the Washington Post, including The Economist, for God's sake, The Economist of all places.
Had to deal with it. I mean, the Times, when they'd refer to it, it's 88 paragraphs in, but it would say, you know, there's really no legal basis for this, and it's kind of bizarre, but.
Right, yeah, and that you always got to read that 89th paragraph.
That's true.
You know, what did Gore Vidal say? Was it Gore Vidal or was it Noam Chomsky? I can't remember, but they would say, you know, the most important thing to do when you're reading the New York Times is to read the last paragraph first and then read only the first and last sentence of each paragraph after that.
Is that sign that said that?
I don't remember, but in any case, you know, it's like Pravda, you know what I mean? It's like Pravda right. In the Soviet Union, you know, if you want to understand what's going on in the Soviet Union, when you read Pravda, you read it and you assume everything is the opposite. you know.
Well,
and
what they used to do, though,
that's the old joke from the Soviet Union. If you wanted to know what was going on, right, you had to read Pravda upside down, you know, and, right, and read between the lines. But
what they, what, you know, what was interesting though, and it's true today as well. But it was even true during the Soviet Union. They had available to them New York Times and such, and early on CNN and those outlets, so they could read Pravda and then see that and do a little balancing. We don't quite have it like that.
Well, we kind of do now in a sense, because we have these non-Western alternatives which are really kind of penetrating the media space. So, you know, I think that there's something definitely good in that, although there is a danger too in becoming over-reliant on any given source, and that's always a problem. But anyway, without waxing poetic on the nature of media, I do want to come back to what you brought up a few minutes ago about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, because this is really important. And it was, you know, we talked all about it last week, but just to highlight, you know, the Brexit vote really overshadowed the SCO summit in Tashkent. And I think that was a really important moment. Obviously, the most significant for the global picture is the accession of Pakistan and India to the SCO. But as you were mentioning, and you're absolutely right, a raft of deals was signed, and that is pretty much par for the course every year that this happens. But you can see how so many of these deals and so many of these projects are sort of swirling around the vortex of the One Belt, One Road. I mean, the One Belt, One Road has now become sort of the main artery through all of Asia and Eurasia, around which all of these other projects are sort of being organized. So whether it's the delivery of electricity to Pakistan via these large electrical grid, these electrification programs, or if it's the movement of energy across Myanmar into southwestern China, or it's the development of the bases in the South China Sea or what have you, all of these different issues are sort of swirling around the One Belt, One Road, New Silk Road, Maritime Silk Road initiatives. And man, I tell you, if you listen to the establishment here in the West, you know they look at this as a tremendous threat. Now, they won't say it that way. They'll use buzzwords like, you know, governance and transparency and this and that and whatever. But ultimately, the consensus from the West is One Belt, One Road is a very real threat to Western hegemony in Asia. There's no doubt about that. So there's no way to look at the things that are happening in Asia without looking at it in that context. And similarly, the moves by Russia and China to increase their cooperation, that is also something that is deeply worrying to the West. And we could provide a couple of examples of that, including the Eastern Pipeline, right? That's the pipeline, from Eastern, the far east of Russia, going down into northeastern China. That's a very critical linchpin of that broader energy cooperation agreement. And then in the West, you also have the Altai pipeline bringing Russian energy to Western China, particularly to Xinjiang province, where the Uyghurs are. And that is that critical region of Western China, which is growing exponentially right now. I mean, Urumqi, the capital of Xinjiang, has become like a haven, a sanctuary for engineers, for Chinese engineers and highly educated, upwardly mobile Chinese young people who are moving there to take part in things like the construction of an international airport, which is going to be very critical development there. The construction of these transit hubs, which are going to link from Xinjiang province going west into Kazakhstan, which figures centrally in China's plans as well. You also have Urumqi and Xinjiang as sort of the crossroads between central Russia and Pakistan and India and access to the subcontinent. So there's all of these things. I mean, if you pull out a map and you look at what's happening and you were to plot all of the major economic development initiatives, it's pretty obvious what's happening. And believe me, that's not lost on planners in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at the development of the largest continent on the planet and a good part of its neighbors. Looking at the development of of the projects, infrastructure, like you're describing, you also see going further west on that map, an interesting construction of instruments of soft power. If you look at the recently successful St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, which is becoming another place where people sign all of these all of these deals, and you know, is in the process of making St. Petersburg an important financial center, well, an important economic center. Also, the development of Sochi for the Olympics, but it's become another place where people gather from all over the world and make business deals. And, you know, Moscow, of course, has always been a stop-off if you're making a tour of power centers of the world. You know, for since the Soviet Union was first started, that became one of the locus points. So, you know, you have infrastructure being built and, like, the political economy being developed as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Now, we should be clear, though, some of the growing financial institutions are not, you know, these are not simply Chinese, right? So you have at the initiative, at the sort of the instigation of China, the establishment of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. But the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank has plenty of Western partners, too. In fact, most of the West wants in on the Asian Infrastructure That's right. Investment Bank, and in the governance
They're going to make money.
What's that?
They're going to make money.
Yeah, of course, they're going to make money. But, you know, what I'm getting at, though, is the governance of the bank. It's not like, you know, it's just handpicked by the Chinese Communist Party. There's actually pretty significant international representation there. Yep. It's actually... to be honest, in many ways, even though it's very much in its infancy, in many ways, it's far more representative of the global landscape than is the World Bank Correct. Or the IMF or right. their board That's of right. governors. That's you know, right. so, you know, one of those things that China has always complained about is the lack of influence that it has on these Western financial institutions. And yet, when China moves to establish a financial institution, the West is very well represented there. That's and right. I think that that is important because I think that is a little bit of an insight into the Chinese character and into the Chinese mentality as far as economic development goes. They're not trying to simply use these things as vehicles of their own political power. I mean, obviously, they're partially that. There's no denying that's how it works. But they're also actually quite willing to engage in what I would call mutually beneficial cooperation, in particular when it comes to the financial sector. The Chinese are realistic and they have long-term visions, and they understand that the creation of a truly independent financial architecture globally is not something that can be done overnight. You can't unmake the sort of neo-colonial or imperial financial systems that have been sort of concretized over the last 100 years. You can't remake that overnight. And so it's happening incrementally. And that's really, I think, something to keep in mind because yeah. every time we have one of these incidents, you know, or one of these conflicts emerging, like, you know, this absurd lunatic Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter doing these photo ops on these U.S. destroyers in the South China Sea. Every time you see something like that, you have to put it into the context of how the U.S. is trying to undermine this sort of vision that the Chinese have. You know, the 50-year quote-unquote Chinese dream. That's very, very important because that's really what's shaping Asia right now, and obviously the U.S. is very fearful of that.
You know, Xi Jinping gave an interesting history of the Chinese Revolution at the Congress of the Communist Party of China Thursday or Friday. I don't remember. Did you happen to catch that?
No, I know that it was the 95th, yeah. the 95th Congress, the 95th right. anniversary, and yeah. I saw a couple of excerpts, but why don't you tell us?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. Well. It was interesting in that it corresponds precisely with the view that you are imputing to the Chinese leadership. They're taking a long view, and President Xi Jinping laid out the history of China from, you know, the early part of the 20th century and the development 95 years ago of the CPC and the project that it has been working on that has brought China to where it is right now. And he laid out some of the plans going forward. And it takes that kind of long-term view. I mean, to me, the mental image you get, if you want a cartoon image, is like a million people walking forward and someone throwing, you know, lighting fires in front of them and then retreating and lighting another fire. But the million people are coming and they just steadily walk forward.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Although, you know, it's like, you know, trying to set a fire in front of them, set a fire behind them, you know, dig a ditch and cover it over with some leaves.
Yeah, it's multivariated. I agree. There's a comprehensive, you know, they're trying to assert total, you know, full spectrum dominance. And certainly they are throwing fires into every little opening that they can find them among the million people.
Well, yeah, and this is part of the reason why when we say the great game, we're not just saying that because it's a nice little alliteration. You know what I mean? It really does seem to follow a very similar pattern to what you saw between the British and the Russian empires in Central Asia, in particular. Beginning in the early 19th century. You know, just to keep in mind, right? You have the political landscape of the time. You have these khanates. Right, these localized rulers who are basically falling away. The Ottoman Empire is collapsing, and you have a whole swath of Asia that was basically up for grabs. And the British were, in many ways, very concerned that Russian influence into Central Asia would jeopardize British control of the subcontinent, particularly, obviously, the crown jewel of the empire in India. So you similarly see today that the U.S. is very concerned that what China is doing is going to fundamentally challenge U.S. hegemony in Asia, in the Far East, which it's had undisputed since World War II. And actually, we might even be able to go back further than that, although Japan is a complicating factor there. But U.S. influence and U.S. and Anglo-U.S. control goes back a long way in Asia. Obviously, the subjugation of China, during the Opium War, and the Boxer Rebellion and all of that. I mean, we know that history, and believe me, the Chinese know it too, and they haven't forgotten it. And the Chinese look forward with a view towards rewriting these historical wrongs. Not that they want revenge necessarily. What they see in China is basically a great civilization of humanity, perhaps the greatest long-standing civilization in human history that has basically been dormant for about 200 years or so, and now they're coming back, and they're coming back hard, and the U.S. is terrified.
You know, finally, you mentioned the model of the investment bank, the development bank, as showing the willingness of China to collaborate and to share power. And you could look to Hong Kong as an example of that as well. And the response from the West, of course, these occasional uprisings that take place in Hong Kong with the full media coverage here of freedom fighters fighting the Chinese communists or however it gets portrayed in a particular day.
Yeah, well, and Hong Kong is an interesting case because although it's China, it's also in many ways not China. And, it's a part of China, but it also has a very significant level of independence. And remember, it's the jumping off point for HSBC, right? I mean, one of the largest banks in the world, one of the beacons of British capital. And, the things like real estate and just the cost of living in Hong Kong is very, very high because of a lot of these influences of Western capital in Hong Kong. And that has been sort of allowed by China. They've allowed Hong Kong to maintain that status, to maintain its sort of Western orientation. And it's not because, you know, the Chinese necessarily want to give the British and the Americans a foothold, you know, in China. It's because they understand that in the long term, Hong Kong provides a very useful service to China. There's a lot of highly educated, Western-minded business and Western-minded educated young people who come out of Hong Kong. And China is looking at developing a new generation, one that is not as, let's say, materialistic and capitalistic as the one that has grown up in the last 25 years, but one that is a bit more ideologically oriented oriented towards Chinese-style communism. That's one of the major initiatives from Xi Jinping, is bringing back Marxist education, bringing back ideology into the schools and into the classroom, so that these young people who are growing up under the Xi Jinping era are not going to be like the ones who grew up under Deng Xiaoping. They're not going to be the ones who are seeking profit at all costs. They're going to be the ones who are going to look towards building a bigger and better, more sustainable China. Look, there's a number of places where they've made major progress, including environmental issues, including, you know, controlled growth and things like that. China is maturing before our eyes. It's not just developing at breakneck speed like it was 15 years ago. They are now developing into a real-world power with understanding not only its potential, but also its limitations. You see that in the stock market. You see that in real estate. You see that in a lot of areas. China is maturing, and that, I think, is very worrying to Washington, because they're not quite sure how to stifle that.
Eric, pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.